Hey, Old Moles. This is Luisa Martinez, and today I'll be speaking with Austin Gonzalez of the Democratic Socialists of America. Austin Gonzalez is a Virginia-based organizer of Puerto Rican descent, and he's currently on the National Political Committee of DSA. He helped found the Richmond, Virginia's DSA chapter and assisted in the foundation of other chapters around the state. Austin was part of two important delegations on behalf of DSA. One to Peru as an election observer, and the second with me to Venezuela as delegates to El Congreso Bicentenario de los Pueblos del Mundo, or the Bicentennial Congress of the People of the World, a couple weeks ago. And I gave a report back on my trip, which we can link on the website. I was able to go to Venezuela, but not Peru. And so today we speak with Austin, who can give his perspective on what he was able to learn down south. Austin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me here, Luisa. I'm very excited to have this conversation.
Wonderful. Okay, so let's touch on Venezuela first. So I think the particular interests and something that I said I was going to talk about last time were the communes of Venezuela. So can you kind of give a brief summary of the movement for communes in Venezuela?
I could easily talk about the communes for a good 5 hours straight. So I think the communes, when I think of the communes, I think of them as such a very special project, not for Venezuela, but for socialists across the world, right? It was in Hugo Chavez's final speech, right? His famous strike at the helm, golpe de timón speech, where he quite famously uttered the catchphrase now, which is all across Venezuela, comuna o nada, right? Commune or nothing. What was he talking about, right? What are these communes? Commune or nothing? What does that mean? Well, as I'm sure a lot of people listening know, right? Venezuela is a country that has been, I would say, attempting to transition to socialism for a couple of decades now, right? For the first whole decade of the quote-unquote Bolivarian Revolution, for the first whole decade of, you know, the advent of socialism or whatever we want to call it in Venezuela, right? A lot of what manifested itself kind of came from the top level down. A lot of what manifested itself was Hugo Chavez and PSUVE, or at the time, the Fifth Republic movement, kind of combating with the former right-wing forces that still had their claws deep within Venezuelan society, right? Combating with a lot of the different right-wing businesses, right? There was the famous oil lockout in the early 2000s, right, against Chavez. There was the coup against Chavez in 2002. So that first decade, a lot of the struggles in Venezuela, a lot of that was just combating the right. It wasn't until Chavez's final speech during the beginning of the previous decade, right, the 20-teens, that Chavez asked, where is the commune? We've been building toward this for over 10 years now. Where is the building block of socialism on the ground level? Where is the community coming together to build socialism, right? And this moment was very important because Chavez also had all of his cabinet ministers lined up feeling very awkwardly, right? Kind of like basically shaming them like, hey, is there bureaucratic issues here? Where is the commune? And the reason I mention this and the reason I give this background here, and I'll try to be brief, is because it's critical context for why the commune project is what it is in Venezuela today and why it's so important, right? After that speech and after Chavez's death and now the presidency of Nicolas Maduro, we've really begun to see a flowering and blossoming of the commune project in Venezuela. I'd say probably the most notable example that I love to give people right off the bat to give them a kind of an idea of what the communes in Venezuela are like, and I know where I imagine we'll talk about this a little bit in a little bit more detail here, is El Maizal, right? El Maizal commune, which is in, I believe, Portuguesa state, right? Which is kind of in like central western Venezuela, right? And El Maizal is a giant corn commune. They make corn there. Corn is, you know, like many Latin American countries, corn is a critical component of the Venezuelan diet, right? So El Maizal is this massive corn commune where all of the people who work there, they work in every decision they make, they vote on, right? All the proceeds they get from selling the corn, they hold in commune and in common, right? They have a community bank. And this is why I say when I look at the communes, when I look at things like El Maizal, these are the true building blocks of socialism, right? This is the beginning, or at least I'm a proponent of the Bolivarian Revolution, if you haven't figured that out by now. This is what I say is, once again, the true beginning of the manifestation of socialism, the manifestation of workers truly owning the means of their production. And Luisa, when we went down there to Venezuela, right, you remember, I was jumping for joy when I found out that we would be meeting communes, because I'm just a guy over here in Virginia, right? To actually be able to see this firsthand was such an enlightening experience. And once again, we literally could talk for hours about just each commune visit in and of themselves, because once again, being able to see these people struggle, especially in the face of blockade, in the face of sanction, seeing these people struggle to build these communes, build these communities that once again hold all the things they hold, they make in common, was truly an amazing experience. And we visited a bunch of different communes. I think one of my biggest takeaways when I think about going down there and seeing these communes firsthand is how much they do. I was always under the impression, because I was, once again, just a nerd, right, who reads books and stuff. I was always under the impression that these communes specialize in certain things, just like I mentioned El Maizal. To go there and see places like Comuna Luisa Cáceres, right, and seeing how they basically did everything. Comuna Gran Mariscal de Ayacucho, I think is what that one was called. How they do everything, right? Making clothes for themselves, making food for themselves. They even had their own security guard. You remember that guy? They literally did everything. So once again, I'll leave it there on that question, because once again, I could literally go forever just talking about a bird's eye view of the communes themselves.
Yeah, one of the more interesting things that I picked up is we got to speak to a couple communards. Of them, most famous is Angel Prado. He's kind of referred to as the president of the communards. He recently won his party's primary to run as the mayor of Simón Planas. And one of the things that was mentioned in that conversation was really this effort to re-envision what we consider work, right? So the first commune that we visited, this was in Caracas, a middle-class part of Caracas. And I think the idea was that you devoted 4 hours a week to literally help building the commune, right? We visited what was a half finished structure that was going to be housing for people. And so really having people understand that there's a new way to envision one's labor and how one's labor can be produced. But let me ask, what was your takeaway from our conversation with Angel and the other communards?
Angel Prado is such an interesting guy for so many reasons, right? Angel Prado, one of the reasons I feel like he's kind of, you mentioned, he's like kind of like the president of the communards, right? I feel like he's almost attained like folk hero status for like a lot of, comuneros in Venezuela for a lot of good reason, right? And one of the reasons I find him so fascinating is because often he comes in conflict with the state. Often he comes in conflict with PSUV. And I love one of my biggest takeaways from conversing with Angel Prado, right, is kind of, you mentioned them trying to re-envision work and whatnot, right? I also see through Angel Prado and El Maizal's conflicts with the state, I see the beginnings of the communes battling the bureaucracy. And part of the reason they're in that battle is because they're assuming the roles of the state in many ways. In Venezuela, we saw a state that was very much weakened because of sanction, right? It's very difficult for them to provide for their people. So for these communes to be able to provide as much as they do, truly, like, and I know this sounds so dramatic for any of my Marxists out there, right? I feel like I truly see the beginning of the withering away of the state, so to speak. And that's why, to me, Angel Prado is such an important and interesting figure, because he's one of those people that, as you mentioned, Luisa, he was at the Congress, so he's not out here boycotting the government, even though he does come in conflict with them, right? He recognizes the dialectical relationship that the communes have with the government, this dance that the communes do with the government, where, maybe your local bureaucrat is not the best person in the world, but you don't say, I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and okay, actually PSUV is this evil dictatorship. No, they grapple with the actual contradictions that exist within their society. And it forces them to ask very difficult questions of what is the relationship between a truly autonomous workers' commune and the state itself. But once again, I could go on for extremely long about that as well.
Well, it really highlights the different positions that people play within the Venezuelan socialist project. So obviously people who are, who are communards and who are drawn to those types of projects, they are to the far left of what we consider kind of one's political consciousness. And naturally that would sometimes come into conflict with something like a mass party, PSUV, or the Grand Patriotic Pole, which is a coalition government. And so they maintain power by, I don't think they have any choice, by sometimes making concessions, right? Just as a way of maintaining maintaining control and maintaining the support of elected people. And so that's something that I really walked away with from our trip. The importance of understanding the dynamics of that struggle and how we could all learn from it as socialists. But let's switch gears for a second. You also visited Peru to observe the elections there. So first off, let me ask, you kind of hit some, there was some pushback when you got there. Could you explain that?
First of all, yes, I did also visit Peru. I had quite an interesting summer, I must say, going to both Peru and Venezuela and seeing the things that I see. So I'm assuming this is what you are referring to. And if not, please enlighten me, because there are many different ways that I could take this question as far as pushback that we received both before and after we landed. Funnily enough, it was clear to me that we arrived in, and anybody who follows like politics in Latin America, this is no surprise, but it was very clear to me that we arrived in a very polarizing atmosphere, right? I spent all my time in Lima, I should be very clear, and this was a deeply fractured place. The first thing I saw, literally as soon as I landed, was a giant billboard. Or I should say the first political ad I saw when I landed was a giant billboard. And you want to know what that giant billboard said? It said, Cinco días para votar no al comunismo, right? 5 days to vote no to communism. So that's the kind of campaign that the right wing and Keiko Fujimori were running. And if you, and when we would talk to average people about this, you know, we would ask people in Lima, which was kind of like a right wing Keiko Fujimori stronghold, we would ask them like, oh, well, who are you voting for? For anybody who said they were not voting for Castillo, they would say, oh, Terruco Senderista, you know, things like that. He's a terrorist. He's with the Shining Path, things like that. And it was clear that the campaign that Keiko Fujimori was running was a very negative one. And that was extraordinarily clear to us, as opposed to, you know, Castillo supporters who would talk to us about the new constitution, right? They'd also talk to us about ending the corruption of Fujimorismo, right? So once again, I arrived in Peru to a very polarizing atmosphere.
So can you give us just briefly a background on Professor Pedro Castillo, who ended up winning the election?
So Pedro Castillo is such a fascinating dude, right? To me, the bottom line is he is an organic representation of the Peruvian people in every sense of the word. And what the hell do I even mean by this? There were massive protests in Peru late last year that led to the resignation and I think not the impeachment, but basically like the forced stepping down of a president for pressure, right? So things were all falling apart. Pedro Castillo, as a leader of the of teachers unions in Peru, right, had been a part of different protest movements in Peru, hence his nickname El Profe, right, as a leader of teachers unions. Pedro Castillo was able to tap into this anger, was able to tap into this resentment that a lot of Peruvians had toward the system and channel it into his campaign. It was a shock to me and to the international community to even see Pedro Castillo make it to the second round. So Pedro Castillo, an amazing figure. He carries a giant pencil around with him wherever he goes during his campaign. So that's also also extremely awesome.
You managed to get a giant pencil as a token. Congratulations. So could you briefly kind of summarize why is Pedro Castillo's election important for, say, leftists in the United States?
We just got to think about Peru. Peru is the former seat of the Inca Empire, right? Peru is an immensely resource-rich country, right? Second largest copper reserves in the world. They have some of the largest gold reserves in the world, some of the largest guano in the world, right? It's amazing how resource-rich Peru is. Hence, Pedro Castillo's famous catchphrase, right? No más pobres en un país rico. No more poor people in a rich country, right? And this is one of the biggest reasons why this is critically important to leftists, not only in South America, but also leftists in North America and the United States. This is Peru, a critically important part of South America and a critically important country within South America. Also, a historically right-wing country in South America. This is a country that has been very right-wing for like the last basically it, okay, maybe not its entire existence. Well, no, yeah, basically its entire existence. Like, this was a country that he was even right wing during the Wars of Independence, right? When Bolivar and San Martin were coming through. So like, this is a country that was the seat of the Spanish monarchy, right? There's deep entrenched reaction within Peru. So to see Peru, this right-wing country where the Lima group was literally capitaled, the right-wing alliance, that is, to see Peru go left-wing is a earth-shattering development for South American politics, to put it lightly.
Yeah, and it certainly has implications for us in the United States to see a country that has such an entrenched history of right-wing leadership move to the left. I think it's very inspiring. So let's finish there. Austin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Louisa.